thank you all very, very much for coming to this latest in our Lisi Visiting Speaker Programme. It gives me great pleasure to welcome our speaker this evening, Professor Florian Bieber. Really doesn't need much of an introduction to you all, but I will outline his career to date anyway. As you will be aware, he's Professor of Southeast European Studies and Director of the Centre for Southeast European Studies at the University of Graz in Austria. He studied at Trinity College in the United States and the University of Vienna and Central European University, and received his PhD in political science from the University of Vienna. His research interests include institutional design in multi-ethnic states, nationalism and ethnic conflict, as well as the political systems of Southeast Europe. He has published articles on institutional design, nationalism and politics in Southeast Europe in Europe-Asia Studies, Nationalities Papers and many other journals. He is the author of Nationalism in Serbia, From the Death of Tito to the Fall of Milosevic, as well as a book on post-war Bosnia, Ethnic Structure, Inequality and Governance of the Public Sector. The title of his talk tonight is The Crisis of Democracy in the Balkans, the Interrelationship Between Europeanisation and a New Authoritarian Temptation. Florian.
Well, James, thank you so much for your hospitality and for inviting me to speak tonight. And thank you all for coming. I will try to make this as entertaining as possible. I will start with a few quotes from a book which was written not connected to the Balkans, but one which provides maybe some insight into the journey which I will planning to take you for the next 40 minutes or so. And then afterwards, we'll have time to talk. It's a little book by a good old Niccolo Machiavelli, known as the Prince, which he wrote a few centuries ago. And reading it in the light of looking at the topic of today, I thought it is, as usual, inspiring reading. And so I would like to read to you a few passages which I found particularly pertinent. And in fact, some of them I stumbled across when I was working on the just aforementioned study of Serbian nationalism and the rule of Milosevic of the 1990s a few years ago. So they don't go out of date, and they are useful in different contexts. So the first one, he says, talking about a ruler, he was always planning great enterprises which kept the mind of his subjects in a state of suspense and admiration and occupied with their results. And these different enterprises followed so quickly one upon the other that he never gave man a chance deliberately to make any attempt against himself. So this is the first one. I shall indulge you with a few more of those, and then I shall talk a little bit more, some more recent analysis rather than going back. A prince should be careful never to allow anything to escape his lips that does not abound in the above-named five qualities, which he talks about, being merciful, faithful, humane, religious, and upright. And the last one I shall say here is that a prince who relies upon their words without having otherwise provided for their security is ruined. For friendships are won by rewards and not by greatness and nobility of the soul. There are many other useful quotes here, but I will start out with what I would consider 10 rules which Machiavelli might write today for the Balkan prince, whoever he or maybe even she may be. Control the elections, but not on election day, but before. Control the media, but make sure you have many voices which all say the same and have your own junkyard dog. Talk about the EU and wanting to join us, but make it a little bit hot, a little bit cold, depending on the day. Talk about fighting corruption and reforms. Talk and talk and talk and jail a few. Solve problems with your neighbors to get praise and create a few to be popular. Pick different foreign friends. Some of them will like you for what you are and some of what you claim to be. Hire your voters, fire your opponents. Don't have an ideology, it can only hurt you. You are a boss, not a politician. Promise change, but make sure it always stays the same. So what I would like to talk about today is what I consider to be a regional pattern of rising authoritarianism. And I've argued this in an article a year ago for the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, where I've talked about an authoritarian temptation. Now, this is the same term which the European Stability Initiative used a decade ago in Bosnia, but it has a different meaning. So what I'm talking about is what I consider to be the rise of governments in the region of Southeastern Europe, which have clear authoritarian traits, I don't consider them to be dictatorships, but I consider them to be seriously undermining democracy. And, you know, I guess I'd need to maybe just mention three vignettes of that of recent times to show the pertinence of that. So we have just very few days ago statements by Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić about the Biran investigation of the dewatering of the Tamnava mine, the tender for it. And he accused multiple times Biran of spreading falsehoods. And he noted for Prva television a few days ago, "I've protected Serbia from falsehood. If I wouldn't have done it, unfortunately, I'm afraid no one would have." So he is, of course, sacrificing himself for the sake of the nation. This has got nothing, this is not personal. In Montenegro, in the last year, we've seen a very, and again, a very dirty campaign against Vanja Čalović of the NGO MANS, who's been quite critical of the government. She was attacked by a tabloid known as Informer, which has also played similar roles in its reporting in Serbia and attacking the opposition. And it's clearly been both useful for the Serbian and the Montenegrin government. And just in Macedonia, we've had the upholding of the sentence of a journalist a few days ago, and also just in December, a large protest of students over a rather arbitrary education reforms, which came very heavy-handed top-down. Now, these are rather serious issues coming from two countries which are in active negotiations for EU membership, and one which has been proposed by the European Commission for years to start negotiations. So these are not at the tail end of the Western Balkans EU process. So there's a certain paradox, and this is, in fact, what I'm interested in is to see about how can we explain this tension between EU accession on one hand and apparent deficiencies when it comes to democracy on the other. Why are the front runners apparently doing at least not better than the ones at the end of this process? And what is this new crisis of democracy in the Western Balkans coming from? Now, and again, this is not to say that this is not without its tensions, and I think it's the tensions which I want to draw your attention to. So, Djukanovic himself has noted a few weeks ago that Montenegro might consider the Iceland scenario. Iceland scenario meaning, of course, in this case, not the complete financial collapse of the country, but rather rather withdrawing from EU accession talks. He said, but a candidate country has the right, as Iceland did, to say, sorry, I don't like this company anymore, Djukanovic said, which, of course, is interesting to come from him, talk about company. Vučić, again, in response to this critique of the Biran investigation, said very explicitly, they got the money from Davenport and the EU to speak against the Serbian government. So this is a government which is in accession negotiations with the European Union, which is accusing the EU head of delegation in Belgrade of supporting an opposition website of undermining the government. I mean, it seems like quite a paradox. So what is going on? Now, so the first part is, of course, that we had a crisis of democracy or authoritarian rule in the 1990s. Now, I'm arguing that what we're witnessing now is distinct from what was there in the 1990s. So let me just briefly point and identify the key markers of what characterized the semi-authoritarian regimes of the 1990s. First of all, they were characterized by war and nationalism as strategies used to consolidate their power. And again, I think some authors like Chip Gagnon have argued persuasively that it wasn't the popularity of the war of nationalism which gave them the edge, but rather their use of diffusing the opposition, which have been influential. The second element is they were able to draw on the structural legacies of the late socialist period. Both the parties which had been continuous in power, like in Montenegro and Serbia, as well as those who changed hands in 1990 but retained many of the tools of power. And I think we see this in Croatia, where from the security apparatus to other parts of the state, they were taken over by the HDZ in the 1990s. We also have media control in a way where not just private media, but in fact primarily state media. And again, this is something which we don't have anymore available. And then election fraud. Right? So this is another clear phenomenon which we had. We had either non-recognition of election results like we had in Zagreb in the late 1990s, or ballots found in trash bins in different locations in Serbia in the late 1990s as well. So how did this period come to an end? First of all, elections were which were heavily monitored by NGOs who found the ballots in the trash bins and exposed it, who counted ballots in parallel and made it hard for the government to lie about the results. The end of the wars and the inability to mobilize along national issues, both for defeated and winners of the wars, so both in Croatia as well as in Serbia, and the exposure of those weaknesses. So one of the key tools used in the 2000 election campaign in Serbia was the White Book published by G17, which listed all of the detrimental socioeconomic pillars of the situation in Serbia as a result of the wars, the sanctions, the refugees, and so on. And then finally, corruption. So, you know, Ankica Tuđman's bank account, for example, the wife of Franjo Tuđman, who deposited 239,000 Deutschmarks in a bank account, and the bank employee thought this was rather odd, considering that in the declared assets, this money was nowhere to be found. And this is one of those turning events where people turned against the Tuđman system, not because of the use of nationalism, but because of the obvious corruption and abuse of state funds. So this period ended, and many of the parameters which enabled authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes in this period are no longer in place. There are no wars to be fought. Media has been privatized, in fact, for the most part, or many of it in foreign ownership. Election fraud and the way in which ballots were trashed or were filled out in the ease in which it was done in the 1990s is no longer possible. Serbian presidential or parliamentary elections cannot be won in Kosovo anymore in the same way it was possible in the 1990s. And similar other election manipulations are no longer that easily possible. So what happened in that period after 2000? And again, I've given mostly referred to Serbia and Croatia, but I think this is a broader pattern most visible in those two countries. So we see a short move towards democratization, which really lasted only 3 to 4 years. If you look at all of the major indices of democratization, whether it's Freedom House or the Bertelsmann Transformation Index, looking at Southeastern Europe, it is quite striking to observe that the shift in all of the measurements of democracy, from whether it is civil society, electoral process, governance, and so on, occurred really in this period, and afterwards has stagnated. Now, again, we can have a discussion about the problems of these indices, and I'm not... I wouldn't endorse them wholeheartedly, and I'm quite aware of the limitations they have. Yet I think they are indicative of a phenomena, which is that we see Southeastern Europe moving from more authoritarian rule to democratic rule in this brief window, this brief period, and then basically maintaining a very continuous status, which is well below that of consolidated democracies elsewhere. And of course, this is not a status which is meant that the region is invariably stuck in it, or this is unchangeable. And it doesn't mean that regression isn't possible in other countries, even Hungary being the most prominent example in the countries which joined the European Union. But it is striking to notice that the countries of former Yugoslavia, but also Romania and Bulgaria, have a consistent pattern which is underperforming in regard to democratic movement towards more liberal democracy. So this period is a period which is still very much associated with the government by parties which are not associated particularly with authoritarianism. But we already observe there in this long period of stagnation of the 2000s, essentially, at least from the mid-2000s onwards, that the parties which come to power are unable or unwilling to overcome many of the structural impediments towards consolidation of democracy or liberal democracy, I should say. So we still see, for example, a very strong party control over public administration. Now, this might be the case of parties which change. There might be an alternation in power, like in Serbia, where we have multiple coalition governments, and this is something which, for example, already Vesna Pesic noted a decade ago, where we have the first Kushunitsa government, which is a coalition government, coming into power in 2004, where it very much divides up all public administration offices by party key. So this is not one party rule, but multi-party divvying up turfs. Or we have the Montenegrin example, where we have no change of political party in power. We just have reconfiguration of the party restructuring, but not any change over that. And the second, I think, most important feature is the flexible approach to laws, i.e. laws are there, constitutions are there, but they are, guidelines to be taken with a certain degree of flexibility. And this is, in fact, interesting that if we go back to even the early 2000s in a place like Serbia, when we have the first Djindjic government, that already there we have a sometimes flexible approach to laws, again, with perfectly reasonable justification, saying the laws are old Milosevic laws, they're inherited laws, they are straitjackets. But, of course, taking laws as something which is flexible and negotiable opens the door for later, more authoritarian tendencies. So what I'm trying to argue here is that rather than saying that there are three periods distinct and separate since the end of Yugoslavia or the end of communist monopolies over power, an authoritarian 1990s, a democratic 2000s, and more authoritarian return in recent years, I would argue that there's also a certain element of structural continuities between them, which enabled the return or the strengthening of more authoritarian approaches in recent years. And I would say it begins with the coming to power of Milorad Dodik in the Republika Srpska in 2006, and Nikola Gruevski in Macedonia in the same year, and is continued, of course, with the first Vucic government still in his first role as Vice Prime Minister, which is, of course, one of those nice titles, which I think has become very popular since. And of course, the continuity of the Djukanovic government, which is, of course, the missing link, so to speak, between the authoritarianism of the 1990s and the contemporary period, where we have a great degree of continuity, even though the policy orientation has changed significantly. So how is it possible that we have these governments coming into power? Now, before I address that, can we call them authoritarian? Now, they are authoritarian in the sense that they follow the rules of the prince, rules for the prince of the new Machiavelli, which I've outlined earlier. In the way in which, and we can discuss it afterwards, in the way in which they disregard basic principles of democratic decision-making. They are very clear in their control of the media. They are very clear in terms of party control over the state. So we find that basically you have little chances of becoming a cleaning lady in places like Macedonia if you're not a member of a political party and of the right political party. And again, this is not unique to Macedonia. So these are, the structural penetration of parties of the state is very profound in Bosnia, in Macedonia, in Montenegro, and in Serbia, and in Kosovo, arguably, as well as some other countries of the region. And this means that this has, repercussions on the independence of the state, on decision-making, and on basically the ability for democratic processes. I mean, for many years, the best example of the penetration of the state was in Montenegro, where the government building was owned by the ruling party. Now, this is no longer the case, but this was, for many years, I thought the government was paying rent to the ruling party for being in their building. So you could imagine what would have happened if there would have been a change of government. They probably would have cancelled the rental contract and they would have had to camp out on the streets. But meanwhile, the government has built its own buildings. But of course, the power relationship is still quite clear of who governs whom. Now, how is this possible? How is this kind of return of semi-authoritarianism possible? Now, the first one is, I think, the disappointment with reformist parties, whether they're the Social Democrats in Croatia or DS in Serbia or Social Democrats in Bosnia. There's a sense that these parties were unable to show a different type of government. So in many ways, they behave very similar and, as I've argued, set the path to the return of more a more explicitly authoritarian behavior. The attitude of sui suisti, they're all the same. The fact that it doesn't really matter whether they are extreme nationalists or reformers or liberals or otherwise, they're all the same, so it doesn't really matter. So choice is not really in the hands of the citizens. And I'll come back to that in a second, whether or not that is just perception or reality. And then also, the corruption card, which was seen as the tool to defeat authoritarian leaders, has come back as a boomerang for Democrats, because it is exactly the use of corruption by populist authoritarian candidates which has also been very effective against democratic governments, or ostensibly democratic governments, I should say. So the argument that they are corrupt and that they're unresponsive have been better taken care of by populists. This is a classic populist issue. They are against us. They are not representing our interests. Now, I would like to address an important question here, which is, why do people vote for these parties, right? You can say, well, you know, you can have an easy answer. You can say, oh, these, you know, go back in kind of Balkan stereotypes and say these people don't want any democratic rulers. They are in favor of authoritarian personalities and they like their dictators, and be very comfortable about that, because that dismisses you of any responsibility or further need to understand what is going on. But I think we're missing part of the story here. We're missing the reason why people are voting for different political parties. And here I think anthropologists are doing some very interesting research, and I would like to quote a forthcoming book chapter by Vanya Celebicic, who has done some field work on voters and why people go out and vote in Bosnia, and it's part of a book project edited by Steph Janssen and others on Bosnia. And so she did some research and tried to find out, why do people make electoral choices? What happens there? And she's looking at also people who are active in youth mobilizing, get out the vote campaigns. And she was quite surprised that one of the people she found campaigning to get out and vote, make your voice heard, said that she had promised a friend to vote for Stranka za BiH, Party for BNH, which is the party of former member of the Bosnian presidency, Haris Silajic, because the party had given a job to her best friend's father. So she promised her best friend that she would vote for this party because that would help her father keep her job. Because, of course, if the party would lose elections, her best friend's father would lose the job. But there's a very clear relationship between election and outcome. But she is in a certain way torn, because she's also being offered 100 km, so 50 euros, by Zabolitak, which is one of the other parties in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is kind of called the National Movement for Betterment, I think is the English translation, which is one of the awkward, but it's a party based in Herzegovina strongly. Anyhow, so she wants to vote for them because she gets 50 euros from them, which is not a lot, but times are tough, and so she's torn. So she tries to convince other people to vote for the first party, so not to break the promise to her friend, right? So she gets out and vote. She makes her own private get out the vote campaign to fulfill the tension she's in, that she would like to vote for two different parties, one for the 50 euros in her pocket, the other one for her friend's father's job. And so she's in a real dilemma there of what to do about that. Now, you could dismiss this as an ethnographical detail, but I think this is anybody who is from the region or who has done extensive research on the region knows that this is a very accurate description of the choices why many people vote. Right? Party membership and voting is not based for many because they believe the ideology the party promises or the rhetoric of the party, but because they offer either money in the pocket or a job for a friend, a relative, or otherwise. And it might be the promise of a job or it might be actual jobs. Now, other studies on voting patterns and actually people trying to get jobs have shown that it's not just party membership, which of course gets you the job. It's a very complicated combination of a number of factors. Belonging to the right in Bosnia, belonging to the right ethnicity in the right place, belonging to the right family in the right place, i.e. based on personal connections or Vese, which is, you know, a network, a dense network of ties, party membership as well, and all of the combination of those only allow you to really get certain jobs. Now, again, it's always tricky to generalize, but this is the pattern. And again, you will find this elsewhere as well. Now, you could say, well, these people are awfully short-sighted, aren't they? They are voting for 50 euros. I mean, this is not exactly lots of money. Why don't they vote for the party which offers them, you know, a real job, a real future? Well, the problem is, first of all, parties have tried and have not been able to deliver, or not trying to deliver. The question is, can parties even offer this? Yeah. Isn't the 50 euros a more tangible payoff than the promise of investments coming in and foreigners investing millions and billions into the country, which have been made multiple times over and over, much to the disappointment of the voters, never materialized? So what seems like a short-term or even short-sighted choice might be in fact a very rational choice, and one which is actually much more realistic than voting for a party which offers economic transformation, because again, the record, the personal experience suggests none of them can do this, or at least none of them try to do this. So then why not make choice based on ideological differentiation? Here we come up with a second problem. Even if we don't believe the economic platform, which party is social democratic, which one is conservative? The party affiliations of parties in most countries of Southeastern Europe serve exclusively to allow them to network with other European parties and not to define their ideological positions domestically. So being that the fact that the Democratic Party in Serbia was member of a social democratic party family is something which probably the average voter in Serbia would have never noticed, either by behavior statement or otherwise. But it was a useful channel of influence and communication to other European parties. So party ideology does not serve to differentiate this domestically, but serves to acquire influence and money from abroad. So if ideology doesn't matter, if the promise of economic improvement doesn't matter, so then what are we left with? The offer of a job and the offer of 50 euros. And this might indeed become the logical and rational decisions of voters. There's even a sense of policy void. What policies do you offer? All parties want to join the European Union. So you cannot even vote for one of those parties, Stranka za BiH, za Boljitak, or many of the other parties, that they would offer EU membership and the other ones wouldn't. They all do. Every single party in Southeastern Europe, in Parliament, with very few exceptions, offers EU membership on their platform. And in fact, if you're ever interested in reading party platforms, which makes probably for one of the most boring readings imaginable, and probably also, you know, one of the least read texts in the Balkans, you know, I think, besides, you know, highbrow newspapers, party programs rank pretty low, is read the party program of the Democratic Party of Socialists in Montenegro. If you read that program, you have a party which offers everything and which has completely, programmatically, covers every ground ideologically in its program, from EU to Euro-Atlantic integration, to reform, to justice, solidarity, human rights. I mean, you name it, it's in there. So, you know, what else do you vote for? There's no need to vote for anybody else. So, from that point of view, why do parties even offer ideas and programs? Well, because, of course, you cannot say, I'm the party which is going to do best at hiring your relative, right? Because we pay more, which probably would be the most honest or straightforward answer, is saying, you know, we are the party which offers you 60 euros, not 50 euros. We trump every offer you get by others, right? So that might be, you know, kind of a slogan. But of course, you can't do that. So ideology and the talk of these topics are, to the large part, for the electorate, not genuine efforts to convince them to vote for them, but they are a way to disguise how they actually attain power and at least once they have it, maintain power. So in many ways, one could say maybe elections have become a pyramid scheme where, you know, you have to get one more group of people into it, but you have multiple competing pyramid schemes. So let me bring in the European Union into this equation. How about, why is the European Union not doing something about this? Now, the first element you can say, well, the European Union is, of course, it is looking at the rule of law, it is looking at democratic procedures. But at the same time, I think there are a number of reasons how there is an odd interrelationship between EU integration and these patterns. Now, I'm not arguing the European Union is endorsing authoritarianism. On the contrary, many of the EU officials are very critical and very aware and get personally attacked, as I've cited earlier. But there are structural mechanisms which allow for the European Union to empower some of these tendencies. Now, the first one is what if you read the progress reports of the European Commission, talking about party programs, you know, it's the next category of entertaining reading, is that if you look at their section about the rule of law and democracy, they of course criticize media freedoms, or the lack thereof, of course. They criticize intransparent work of parliament. But there is a certain striking feature if you read them. I've looked at them again, and the latest one in preparation for this talk today. And what is very striking, if you look at them, you know, if you read them across countries, is their in a certain way moral ambiguity in terms of that they don't clearly call names, right? So there are no actors. The actors are only institutions. There are no individuals. There are no power holders. There are no prime ministers. They are the government of Kosovo, the parliament of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and so on and so forth. So that, of course, is, you know, the bureaucratic rational approach, looking at an institution rather than looking at actors. But, of course, the whole point is if we see how structurally political parties are penetrating and controlling state institutions, then, in fact, those actors are not so much the actors, but in fact they are the acted upon in many cases. They are not independent agencies. They are, in a certain way, much more the influence of parties. Political parties are hardly mentioned in the progress reports. They're not even mentioned as separate actors in particular, even though I would argue that they are probably the single most important actor in the countries of Southeastern Europe. You know, democracy, you know, the way democracy functions or doesn't function is the result of the way in which political parties behave. It is also that, when I said this kind of moral ambiguity, is that statements about transparency of the work of a committee in parliament seems to stand equal to, there have been certain attacks on civil society in Montenegro last year. Right. If you know the nature of the attacks, then, you know, criticizing certain attacks on civil society is really not the strength of language you would hope to see in a progress report if you know what happened. So there's a certain degree of course, diplomatic language, which is understandable. But there's also what I would call, again, the phenomena of not seeing the forest for the trees. It disaggregates democracy to so many components of the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, how is civil society participating, that you can answer all of these points rather affirmatively. But when you look at the larger picture, you discover that there are considerable flaws with the overall system. I think if you read the reports about Montenegro, this is quite obvious. I mean, Montenegro is a country which has been governed by, you know, one party and one political leader, Milo Djukanovic, for the last at least, let's say 18 years, if we take a benevolent view of that. But as at least a co-governor since 1991, and with a pretty ruthless control of the state. But that is not transparent from the progress reports. Yes, there are problems with the transparency. Yes, there are little problems here and little problems there. But civil society gets incorporated into the EU accession process. And all of those things, you don't see the bigger picture. You don't see the larger flaws of the process. Now, I take it that, I think if I would talk and I've had this conversation with EU officials, they would say, well, you know, we're trying to keep the process going, so we're engaging. And I think there's a merit to that, but there is a problem also that it also serves to exculpate some of the undemocratic practices. There's also the conflict between larger political questions which are dear to the European Union, understandably, and democracy at home. And I think this has been the most clear when it came to the Kosovo-Serbia dialogue, where this has, at least for a year or two, managed to overshadow any domestic shortcomings of democracy in both countries, very much with the acknowledgement of the European Union. And in fact, the other conflict which we see is that because the European enlargement process is at the moment not a consensual process of all EU member states and the European institutions, we actually see that, for example, the Commission tries to issue as positive reports as possible to keep the enlargement process going, which is understandable, but of course serves the purpose of the pressure on the member states, with the negative side effects that sometimes it might actually let governments in the region off the hook. And I think the reports on Macedonia have been indicative of that, because again, the Commission has been trying to make the strong case that Macedonia is ready to start accession talks, and that the main reason is the Greek veto. But at the same time, of course, as the situation has deteriorated in the last 8 years in Macedonia, this argument becomes increasingly less plausible. But this is, again, how the government is able to use it to not tackle these issues. And the other element is that the European Union in its approach has, of course, been able to has structural difficulties to make the changes visible it provides. I think a very nice example was when you were, if you witnessed the flood in Bosnia-Herzegovina and in Serbia this year, that Russia sent one airplane and immediately with aid, and immediately the Serbian government said, well, this is what, you know, a friendly government does. It provides us with support. Well, in the meantime, the EU had given much more support, financially and otherwise, but it wasn't this kind of PR opportunity which served that purpose. And again, this is an external actor, but external actors and democracy or authoritarian tendencies are closely intertwined. Now, the other element, which is, I quoted made the argument earlier about the need to talk about reform, and I would argue that, well, until recently, and I mean, until not too long ago, corruption, as Ivan Krastev has said, is the nationalism of the new era, that, you know, you don't talk about nationalism anymore, you talk about corruption. Fight against corruption is what, you know, unites people. That's the kind of populist message. But I would say now, Aleksandar Vučić and I think others have discovered reform as a way to kind of have that similar function, to say we are transformative, we are changing things. So this, in a certain way, the use of reform as a rhetorical tool. And I think this comes back to the point I made in the beginning, the quote by Machiavelli about the need of distraction. And, you know, his argument is more subtle than just bread and games, because he's arguing about the need for this, you know, grand projects which draw attention away from the everyday problems. And these grand projects can be wars, or they can be, you know, Belgrade na Vodi, or they can be other these kind of activities which constantly have this activist dimension, and which are able to, in a certain way, overcome and overlook certain structural deficiencies. So I would be far from arguing that the authoritarian trap in which many of the countries find themselves is cannot be resolved, or is in fact indefinite. But I think there are a couple of points which are crucial for understanding them. First of all, they're structural. They're not based on one particular party or one particular leader. One particular leader might be more prone or more able to use them effectively. So, you know, the fact that Aleksandar Vučić got such a large majority in elections is something which others, like his predecessor, were not able to secure. So there is a difference, but it's not one person. It is not just Milo Djukanovic. It is not just Nikola Gruevski, but it is structures, it's systems. It's the way in which parties penetrate the state and have become inextricably linked. And in fact, I often get comments and observations to say that, you know, the party control over the state is greater today than it was in socialist times. in many of the countries. That, in fact, party membership is more important to attain jobs today than it was to attain jobs in socialist period. Because at that period, there were jobs which you could get without party membership. And those jobs have drastically decreased in the meantime. The second point is that the game is no longer about nationalism. And this has been, I think, one of the misleading debates when, for example, Aleksandar Vučić came to power in Serbia, was the question, well, is he still a nationalist or not? And I think that was the wrong debate, because this is not the issue. If you're a good populist, if you want to win elections, you don't talk about nationalism. You talk about other issues. Again, I'm painting a broad brushstroke picture. I know this is different in the Republika Srpska than it is in Montenegro, but just to think that. The other, I think, fundamental element is that it requires the European Union enlargement process to be reconsidered in the way it operates right now, because it seems to inadvertently, I certainly wouldn't argue consciously, inadvertently seems to facilitate a certain type of government which claims to want EU accession, but which is uncommitted to it, which in fact fears it for the reason that they might finish their career a la Sanader in Croatia, but who know what to say. And this is, I think, something which is... I don't have an easy answer for it, but I just think this is something which requires some introspection on the side of the European Union on this matter. That we also need to realize that there cannot be any more junkyard dogs, which was the term used by Fraser and quoted by Richard Holbrooke in his memoirs when he talked about Croatian government at that time, saying that, you know, the US has their own junkyard dog, i.e. the guy who barks and who does the kind of works in the scary neighborhood, so to speak, on behalf of others. I think to some degree we've had the Serbian projection of its friendship with Germany in recent years was an attempt to offer oneself as a junkyard dog, or now it's called the leader in the region or something like that. It's called, you know, it's got nicer terms. But I think one has to be very clear that these kind of policies of favoritism of particular countries or governments to get things done, quote unquote, can only lead to a situation where, in fact, it is serving to consolidate undemocratic practices which in the long run will only backfire. And so with that, I believe that we are, I think, in a longer period where we will see a number of governments in the region stay with the current governments which, you know, over time consolidate their control. Now, they might change. Now, again, semi-authoritarian governments suffer from an inherent tension, right? They're like dancing on a volcano. They talk about EU integration, but they don't want it. So it's a dangerous dance. It's a difficult dance. They have to play by democratic rules, but they don't believe in democracy. So they have to talk about reforms, but they have to always avoid to do the reforms which are really painful. You know, they have to be populist, but be in power. And all of this is not easy. So this dance can often lead them to trip on the wrong side and fall into the volcano. But to believe that the fall of any of these governments alone would usher in the structural changes which will lead to a development of democracy in the region moving towards more liberal democracy by itself is, I think, unfortunately slightly naive. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, a rather pessimistic note, sadly, to...
That's what questions are for.
I know. I just have to make one very... It was interesting when you were talking about party programmes and how people don't read it. And I'm very fond of sort of, when these sort of situations arise, of pointing out where, you know, we tend to sort of take a very negative view of Southeast Europe. But here last week, quite remarkably, but I suppose it sort of rather confirms the point that this takes place everywhere, a journalist from The Telegraph decided to go onto the Green Party website and read about their policies. Now, they've seen the largest growth of any political party in the UK, But it seems that no one had actually bothered to read what their manifesto was, because a lot of it is truly barking. So it was interesting to hear you say that nobody ever, I think it's sadly, I think it's a sort of quite a common theme. We do now actually have quite a lot of time for questions. I immediately see Joan and Laza here. Joan, do you want to go first?
Okay, just to leap right in Yeah, I don't want to simplify what you said or anything, because there's a lot of very interesting and complex stuff, but it seems to me that your starting point is the authoritarian bent and impulse of these parties in the region and their innate venality and so on as the starting point for looking at the problem. And it seems to me that actually what is going on in the Western Balkans is a more extreme version of what we're seeing across the region in Eastern Europe, and certainly in our, and from the EIU, our democracy index, there's not one single, what we designate as a full democracy in Eastern Europe now. Even the Czech Republic has fallen just out into the flawed democracy. So it's an extreme manifestation of the problem, no doubt. But I see the parties more as the kind of expression of the problem, of a much more deep-seated developmental societal problem here that has to do with several kind of major drivers. The parties are not the drivers of the problem at all. I would see it much more as this transition that the region has gone through, which has been a lot of pain and for a large strata of society and not much gain. Problems to do with state development and institutions and the relationship between states and democracy. Also to do with the relationship with the EU and this model that has been pursued in the region, which has in a way undermined a lot of the kind of democratic processes in the region and local decision making and so on. And this void that you talked about, this ideological void, you know, which is the case not just in the Balkans but in all these parties in the region. What do they stand for? And again, that's a more extreme version of what we're seeing in Western Europe and other parts as well. So I don't see the parties really as the starting point for examining the problem. And I'm not saying that there's easy answers here, but that's just to leap in with a few points.
Would you prefer to take simple questions or group?
I think we can group them.
Okay, I saw Laza next.
First of all, thank you very much for a very interesting talk, and as John said, a lot of content, a lot of thought-provoking points. I just make two brief points. First, I wanted to emphasize, which I think John briefly mentioned, when you talk about the influence of the external factor, which you, I forget the exact quote, but you said it was crucial, it was essential in understanding political processes. The thing you omit to mention, I suppose, and I just wonder why, is that in the circumstances where you have protectorates, the most extreme example, but also in other countries that are seeking EU accession, if you have a blueprint, well, where's the room for democratic decision-making? If you have an externally imposed rule in the extreme, like in Bosnia, say, but also elements in other countries. So I just wondered why you sort of ignore that. My other point is sort of on the other side of the coin, the more positive, that maybe there's a danger of exaggerating the trend towards authoritarianism and democratic deficiencies, which you emphasize. And what I mean by that, when you look at the various problems of these societies, the poorly functioning economies, the social problems, and so on, it struck me a while ago that one of the few arguably successful aspects of their transition has been the mere fact that they do have sort of democracies, elections are, with one or two exceptions, are respected, and some of the basic rules have become entrenched, which also suggests that people, despite the cynicism and disappointment and everything, do value this, the fact that they do have these basic democratic rights. So I think that's sort of an important caveat to your story.
I think it's quite a bit there. Should we stop?
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with the points to say that they are more profound or additional structural problems besides political parties. I would fully subscribe to that. I mean, I think I picked out one element which is, I think, overlooked in the institutional analysis of the crisis of democracy as I would see it. But I would see that, I mean, the ideological void, of course, is Europe-wide, right? I mean, we have a broader question of, you know, what does it mean to be a social democratic party in continental Europe or conservative party? I mean, I find it very hard to tell. I mean, and party programs might not be a good indication because probably members don't even read it. And in that sense, policies is what count in the end of the day. And they are certainly, by policies, you cannot find make great distinctions. And certainly in the post-89 period, we found the difficulty. And again, this is some of the issues which I was drawing, pointing for the Western Balkans, which are, of course, for all of the countries, the difficulty of defining and let's say ideological or political profile which made you distinct was very. I mean, I think we see it when we look at political parties from Estonia to Bulgaria that they've struggled to define what they are and to distinguish themselves from others. And in fact, very few parties have been able to do that, and even fewer parties have been able to have a certain degree of stability for this period of time. So there is a skepticism, and I think a justified skepticism of most voters about what parties have to offer. But it's also, I think it's connected to a large degree to the fact that there was a sense that there wasn't much choice to be made, or at least much of the choice was framed as not having choice by political actors after 89. First we have democracy, then we have to have shock therapy, we have to have certain economic policies which are externally driven. They might be justified, they might not be. We can have a long debate about that, but they certainly came from the outside and they were suggested by the outside. Then they had to join the European Union, or they wanted, but then once joining the European Union also was understood to be a process where you had very little agency over. This was something where external actors told you what to do. So the area to form political spaces and to articulate alternatives was very limited, unless you were radical and say, I don't want EU integration, or you offered really kind of radical nationalist platforms. Outside of that, the consensus was so broad that it was very hard to articulate any much policy differentiation. I think this has made it, compounded this problem. And I think we just see the tail end of that in the Western Balkans, what we have more broadly. Now, the question about the protectorates, I mean, I would agree with you that Bosnia is a case where the institutional structure is a product of a peace agreement, but I'm not sure that. It has all kinds of democratic deficiencies which come with that system. I mean, I wouldn't call it a protectorate anymore because you don't have international agents which have any ability or will to intervene. You have a structure which is an externally imposed peace agreement, but again, also one which was accepted by the Bosnian actors at the time, and I think has been accepted by the political parties, of course, for their own benefit, for the most part. But I wouldn't see that as the main cause for the democratic deficiency, because again, I think many of them are very similar in Bosnia as they are in Serbia. So I wouldn't see that the differences are so huge between the countries, as sometimes the debates about Dayton and so on suggest that they are. And is the problem, I mean, is there much, I mean, you know, democratic procedures, I think, are very much entrenched. But then again, I think if we look at the substance of democratic... Right, yeah, absolutely. Although, you know, I would, in some countries we haven't seen it, right? So or not for a while. never, not since 1938, I think, as Dejan Jovic once calculated. Mm. So, but the question is also, you know, do you have a transfer of power? But then again, if electoral participation in the last election in Kosovo, I think, was below 50%, you know, and they're all hovering around 50%, which is in the lower end of the European electoral kind of outcome. And then if many of them vote exactly for the reasons I was outlining, then, you know, enthusiasm for electoral processes is very limited, and understandably so. So yes, I mean, I wouldn't, and this is why, I mean, I don't use the term, for example, of Putinization, as some people use, because I think what we're talking about is not Putin's phenomena. It's maybe Turkey, it's maybe Erdogan, where you have a certain tradition of democratic processes, which are also still there, but you have incumbent leaders who are trying very hard to undo them. So I would certainly see that there are more restraints on outright authoritarianism in the Western Balkans, and I would certainly expect that if Vucic would lose elections, that he would surrender power. I mean, I wouldn't expect all of them. I mean, they have lots of ways to make sure that they will not lose elections all that soon, but they certainly they certainly would accept it if they were to lose.
Okay, Melissa.
Thanks a lot for your lecture. I found it very insightful and very interesting. Two comments and one question. Comments is, why do people vote for the parties that they do vote? And I think apart from expectation of immediate benefit in terms of either money or hiring more relatives or hiring them for a longer period of time, I think the other aspect that one needs to take into account is fear. And there are two sides to this fear. One is that the current authoritarian regimes are much more successful and much more sophisticated in singling out an individual from a group, which hadn't been the case during the 90s, and then attacking an individual as an individual, not as part of a group, in the tabloid media.
Yeah.
And the second is what we are seeing in local elections, for example, in Serbia, is a lot of violent clashes, incidents, fights, which are making people afraid. So there is an aspect of fear. The second comment is the relationship with European integration. European integration of the Western Balkans, I think, was designed to help break the highly charged political problems into technical aspects of European integration and ultimately procedural. As this took a long time, I think this approach degenerated into a sort of bureaucratic incrementalism, where if you read the progress report, you say some progress, limited progress, modest progress, but very rarely you see no progress or excellent progress. So in the end,
Regress.
Progress reports became something which people take home and interpret as they want. So the opposition says, here is on page 33, paragraph 2, I told you that media is not free and the government is saying, but on page 1, this is the best report ever. So there is no holistic assessment as to where the country is going, and to be even more bitter, what is written in the progress report, there are very few things which find themselves in items listed in the enlargement strategy, which is ultimately what the ministers and heads of states and government will be deciding on in December when they are looking at the enlargement package. So I think when you add to this the fact that the relationship between the Commission and the countries, the acceding countries, is, as you said, the one of a dentist and the tooth decade, where there is a mutual interdependence, I think there would need to be a serious rethinking, so that if this process is going to take a long time, which obviously it is, that there is a way for the Commission and the European Union to communicate major messages about where they see a particular country, because very often the Commission's progress report is the only referee in a debate in a country. Mm. And finally, the question, where do you see the role of the tabloid media in bilateral relations within the region? I'm thinking particularly about the Albanian Prime Minister and recently the Croatian President cases that were very interesting. So on one hand, if you open the progress report, you would say there has been further improvement in bilateral relations in the region. On the other hand, you have venting of tensions in a very nasty way, which in the long term, I wouldn't say is good enough.
Yeah. Eric.
Thanks, James. And thanks, Florian. My my question for you is, do you think that the region is unique?
No.
That's it.
I think we could take another question.
Okay, Vasilis.
Let me elaborate. Yeah, because I was thinking in the presentation that you know, fantastic talk and very stimulating, but you didn't mention Albania. So it seemed for a long time like, you know, forming Yugoslavia minus. And then also the first question, that's, well, we see similar things in Hungary, also in Romania, in Turkey, and okay, we start running out of examples, but certainly these things are produced both in space, but also I would think in time. So much of the discussion that you had you know, I could see Greece definitely, let's say, in the 80s and in the 90s, a wave of modernization, perhaps in the 2000s. If you were looking at Greece from the coming from the 60s, you would think, well, there's a democratization that happened for a few years after the after 74, and then within 5-6 years, it all disappeared, and there was state capture and clientelism and everything that really got embedded into state institutions and society, and of course the party system played exactly the role that you were describing. So the point is then, you know, surely, you know, what is unique and what is part of a structural dynamic? You refer to structural. Is it, you know, as you alluded to, that, you know, it's the specific functioning of the state, of the parties? Can it be only EU conditionality, the particular EU conditionality of the Western Balkans, given that also Turkey has that and Greece had that before the EU? You know, can we explore a bit further what is the structure?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so first, I think to Minitsa's point, I absolutely agree with you that fear is a factor which is used extensively. I mean, against those who are individuals who are critical, I mean, and then also as a broader phenomenon. I mean, I noticed this during some visits in the region where people, also in recent years, I mean, more in the last year or so in some countries, where really was people told me that, you know, they're afraid to be critical, not because they, but then their parents might lose their jobs. I mean, the kind of use of collective punishment in families and so on. I mean, you hear about, and I think you know, technology has become quite sophisticated with that, and I think what is also striking is that nobody is looking at electoral processes more carefully, and I think there's a lot of election fraud going on in the region which is not noticed, because it's fairly sophisticated nowadays. It's not ballot stuffing, but it's, you know, the rotating ballot, and it's visits the week before saying, you know, your electricity bill for the last year you didn't pay is 500 euros, you know, do you want to not go to the elections that day because we know you're an opposition supporter, right? I mean, these things happen all the time. Anecdotally, we know it. It's hard to quantify them, but I think they are significant enough to have an influence on election results, and so I think we need to look at them. The question regarding, the use of tabloids, and again, this is, while I think in the 90s a lot of these influences was state-controlled media directly, now you have these independent voices, quote unquote, where you don't even know who's the owner, or it's very at least intransparent for the average reader, which is even more effective because there's a safe distance between the government. This government can always say, well, this is not our point of view. So this is which we've seen with, yeah, I mean, places like Courier, Informer, and whatever else in over the years, and the list is long. And I think it's an interesting point. What you see from that, it's not just a matter of freedom of the media in terms of censorship, but it's also the use of media deliberately by governments to control the public sphere. And we see also, interestingly enough, the failure, which was, you know, 10 years ago, the hope that privatization or sale to Western media groups would help. And first of all, either they've withdrawn, or we have cases like Blitz in Serbia where, you know, what is it, like Vucic writes his diary from Davos and, you know, reads Thomas Mann and, you know, reflects on these things, which, you know, seems rather rather problematic. But there's no clear answer. But I think it also means that the language of, you know, just media freedom by itself is not insufficient to capture what is going on. That, in fact, what we see a lot of places, that media are funded, that we have oversaturated media markets in most countries, where media are supported for the purpose of political influence peddling. So, you know, media are not meant to be a profitable business, but they're meant to be there to buy political favors. And, you know, it's the same thing, but which in fact the Progress Report does note from Macedonia, although, you know, kind of in passing, oh, their government uses advertisement for, you know, in media for, you know, in government-friendly media. And it's kind of stated there as if this is, you know, it's a bit of a problem, but, you know, it means you control the whole media landscape if the government is the main advertiser in the country, because it means that you can't have an independent media if it financially viable. And I mean, and this is a very serious concern. To Eric's question, the answer is no. Absolutely, I wouldn't argue that the region is unique. There are certain features which are unique to it at this moment, or a combination of them. I mean, the fact that it's in the EU accession process adds a particular dynamic which is different to the Hungary, for example.
Except Croatia is not in the EU accession process.
Well, so Croatia is going to be like Hungary a bit more, maybe. But
No, I mean, they're just different dynamics which are ongoing, which doesn't mean that there are certain similarities. You know, I mean, you could bring in, Vasilis was bringing Greece or even Italy or other countries, you know, which Austria has also some features of, you know, populist politics which are quite well known. So absolutely, I would say that there are certain features which come together in the case of the Western Balkans now, which make it unique, but which doesn't make it uncomparable to other moments. And this is, I think, coming back to your question, where I say, of course, you can compare over time. One should compare over time and say that there are experiences which are similar and learn from them. I think one thing which is, though, I mean, maybe Greece is useful corrective there, but looking at other countries, there's, which I often found disturbing in this democracy debates, is that there is this kind of nearly kind of this kind of hopeful understanding that there's this kind of natural progression towards liberal democracy. That, you know, there's always, you know, you're authoritarian and then you move, you know, and then you get stuck, but then you unstuck yourself and then you're going to move to the next phase. And there's this kind of understanding that this is kind of a natural order of things, that it moves in this direction. And I think that there's been this kind of misplaced understanding that this is kind of an automatic process which is just going to happen by its own will, and that, you know, the kind of people who hold it back are just going to be, you know, cast on the dust heap of history by some kind of natural process. And I think rather than that, this is a deliberate, requires deliberate effort. And I think this is what I'm trying to also argue, is that this understanding of this natural progression from authoritarianism to liberal democracy is a bit of a fantasy, which works both ways, and it's not, and you can be stagnating as, you know, as I would call, you know, as I've said sometimes, an unconsolidated democracy for a very long period of time. So these are not, I think we just have to move away from this. If we go to the historical examples, we also have to look at the ones which move backwards, which move both directions in that sense. And I think what is characteristic at the moment is this tension between, on one side, democratic institutions and processes, but elites and actors which undermine those rules, which adhere to them formally but undermine them. And I think there we can certainly find good examples to compare with.
Now, I've got quite a lot of questions, so if people could be fairly... No, it was... No, not to you. It was to ask questions, to be nice and succinct. Adam.
Florian, I was sort of travelled some way down this road with you, and I really like the analysis. But I just wonder whether we're not being unduly blunt. And actually, when you read out the list of recommendations, which I thought was brilliant, recommendations to these leaders, it really reminded me of what's the advice that Samuel Huntington gave to New Democrats, you know, whenever he did that.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very similar. And I just wondered, I mean, this, what is essential, what you're essentially offering is, we should be looking at these countries, this kind of Chantal Mouffe's kind of post-democracy. We need to move away from examine them through that lens. And I actually wonder whether we need to stop on our track and actually think, no, quite the opposite. Let's go back to the 90s. And this, if we were presenting this list of problems to the transitologists of the early 90s, they would say, well, this is fine. These are problems of consolidation. Mm. You know, yes, parties are useful, but they need to be treated with a certain degree of caution. And actually, the more you spoke, the more I think, you know, actually these are basic problems of democratic transition. So my question is simply, are we really overcomplicating it? Are these, should we be reclaiming democratic consolidation or habituation and going back to that Schabowski and all that literature and saying, you know, let's see what the remedies are, let's see what the actual solutions are within that literature.
Thanks, Florian. I was just wondering, because these countries have gone through privatization, like massive portions of their economies have been privatized, how would you conceptualize the role of the private sector in these dynamics? And are they fueling these authoritarian regimes further, or are they actually helping to dissipate
them? And I'll take one more question, just gentlemen right here.
I've got a very short question, because a few minutes ago you said about the democratic tradition. And generally, I think that in the Balkans, the democratic tradition is just boring. It's just boring at the moment. Definitely, they haven't got this democratic tradition, so they have to learn it. So I am from Poland, so I know what I am talking about. We are learning the democratic tradition for 25 years. Mm. They are learning democratic tradition for 15 years. But generally, we had some tradition of democracy between two wars. They didn't have it. So I think that these are the normal processes in their transition into the democracy. And when you look into Macedonia and last election, for example, I would agree that the main basic thing there was the nationality and the fear that Albanians will start or will join the government, will be the power in the government. This is the biggest problem, like, let's say, in Macedonia, yeah? The fight between Macedonians and Albanians. Okay? So generally, I mean, this democratic tradition, this is the main point in the Balkan region.
I think I would agree with I mean, I think Adam's point is well spot on in terms of looking maybe back at that period. No, but I mean, I would still think that, you know, what do we make of the fact that we are having some of those debates which were maybe on the agenda in the early 1990s, 20 years later or 25 years later? I mean, you know, again, I think a lot of the assumptions, and I think this is where also there's an implicit critique. I mean, the whole, you know, kind of consolidation, transition kind of debates, and this assumption about, again, that it's going to move towards the consolidation, and that's going to move to this kind of consolidated liberal democracy. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this really what we're going to see at the end of the day? I mean, again, we see in Central and Eastern Europe that this even assumption there is not as clear as it even seemed 10 years ago, right? I mean, Hungary has moved greatly towards having strongly authoritarian traits and undone a lot of the institutional independence in the last 5 years. So I think this assumption that there's this kind of progression towards consolidation is, I think, something which I think we just have to question. And the second question about the private sector, I mean, I think, you know, of course, in the 90s, we saw very clearly the strategic privatization of two cronies of regimes in Serbia and Croatia and in Bosnia and so on. I mean, of course, now we still have those relationships, but they're not as close anymore because, of course, as privatization has been completed a long time ago, you don't have that ability to directly, you know, kind of directly reward actors. But of course, we find, of course, certain private act. We don't find a vibrant private sector, right? So there's a certain paradox that, you know, when we look at the protests in Bosnia last year, a lot of critique of neoliberalism. And in fact, Bosnia is probably the country which has experienced fairly little of that in terms of. So you don't have a big capitalist sphere of big many businesses, but the limited ones you do have are, of course, organized as a function of political power. I mean, there's no difference between economic and political power, I would argue, in most of the countries. But that's not a result of the strength of the economic sector, but the strength of the political sector. And I think that is crucial. And I think external actors are, and now we see the role of external actors coming in, where governments are using external actors to bolster their support. And, you know, there you get the involvement of the United Arab Emirates, of China, of Russia, which are maybe having less strings attached in their funding than conventional Western FDIs in the past. The last point about tradition, I mean, I'm always careful about the point of that you need democratic tradition to be democratic, because it kind of then a question of how do you ever get there. And the other point is about again, you use the term transition, and again, it's like this. You know, when does it end? You know, and I think the whole term of transition has this problematic idea that there is this beginning and end, and you know when you're done. And, you know, if you would have asked most people in Hungary, they would have said in 2006, 2007, they were done with the democratic transition. You know, that process was finished. And I think now you would find very few who would say that that's quite as clear as it seemed at that time. And again, you know, you can, you know, I think similar observation would have been made in Greece, you know, until elections, or even now, you know, is what does it mean to be a consolidated democracy when you have, you know, these major upheavals of the party system, with parties from the populist left, as well as, you know, the third largest party in parliament being a neo-fascist party. I mean, you know, these are the questions where. The logic of transition has sometimes been a convenient way to isolate quote-unquote consolidated democracies from difficult questions about their own difficulties of democratic consolidation. So in that sense, this kind of comes back to Eric's point earlier that, you know, certainly many of the questions I'm asking in my presentation are questions we have to ask in, you know, let's say, in consolidated liberal democracies as well. And, you know, of course, have some salience there. Not all of them, but certainly some of them.
Okay, well,
It strikes me that there's a sort of parallel between your three political stages of just briefly sort of authoritarianism, liberalism, and then back to authoritarianism, and then three economic stages of transition, recession in the 90s, growth fueled by liberalisation of capital markets in the 2000s, and then recession again. And is there a sort of causal mechanism there? Because obviously it's easier with unemployment shooting up to Greek and Spanish levels again, that a political party can come along and say, threaten people's jobs or offer them money, and that will actually begin to influence them again more strongly.
Go on.
I was wondering whether there might be a possibility for, after, I agree with your analysis that EU kind of tends to push elites and push in this whole kind of authoritarian tendency. I was wondering whether there might be a possibility of a case of Croatia where after the accession there's been this boom of civil initiatives and a new form of politics and democratic. We might not always agree with what they strive for, but there's a new type of politics outside the party political, whether that might be possible in the long run.
Thanks. Tim?
My question is just slightly away from the subject, but not completely so. I'm wondering whether, since it's topical, you could talk about the ramifications of what's happened in Greece. And I'm thinking specifically about foreign policy, and the fact that you have two parties now in government which are staunch defenders of Mr. Putin and his position over Ukraine. And what's that going to do to what's that going to do to the rest of the region, to having that sort of government within the EU and in the Balkans?
Okay. So first to Will's question, I think there's a parallel. I mean, I would say that politics often trails economic development. So I would say that in the last 40 years in the region, only 6 years of economic growth, right, or something like that, between 2000 and 2006, 2007, roughly. And that's the only, before the 90s, we had the decline. We had the 80s, we had the economic crisis in Yugoslavia, since 2008 again. So, I mean, people have lived through economic crisis more than they've lived through normality. So it's certainly easy to see the point that moments of economic crisis facilitate the rise of populists to power. But it's striking that in places like Macedonia, Vomero, and in Republika Srpska, for example, Dodik have risen to power before the economic crisis. And Djukanovic was in power since times immemorial. So in that sense, it seems to be not a complete match. It seems to be that there is some parallel, but it's not kind of that direct. Now, to the question about the new type of politics, and I think we see this also in, we have the student protests in Macedonia a few weeks ago. We have the protests in Bosnia last February. So I think we generally see a lot of these protest movements, which I think are pointing at, I wouldn't share all of their analysis, but they seem to suggest, well, first of all, civic organization and political engagement, and also the critique of representative democracy and the way it operates in the countries. Now, I think their critique is often saying representative democracy is the problem. I would disagree, because I strongly believe in representative democracy, but I understand that the way in which representative democracy works, as I've outlined in my talk, makes it an understandable critique of the way politics works, because if they say party politics does not operate because of some of the points I outlined here, then of course I'm quite sympathetic. So I think there is something going on, and it's not just going on in new EU member states, but also in other ones, which is interesting. It works actually despite external support for civil society. This is spontaneous civil society, not the NGO world, which has been carefully groomed over the last 20 years. So it's quite interesting. Then Tim's question about Syriza and having now a clearly pro-Putin government, which of course is interesting, because now you have two EU member states, north and south of the Western Balkans, which are pro-Russian. I mean, Orban, who's also been quite strongly associating himself with Putin in recent years. And I think this will be encouraging governments in the region to be looking at strengthening their ties, because it makes it harder for the European Union to critique them for doing so. I mean, this has been, of course, the argument of some EU member states has been, you cannot be so close with Putin because it undermines your kind of unity of EU line. But if you have two significant EU member states close next door to the Western Balkans, which say, well, we are also following the same line, it's a lot harder to make this argument. So I think this will create some interesting, I think, encouragement. And, you know, I think we also have to look at which parties has Syriza, for example, been associating itself with in the region. Because, again, I mean, there was a visit of Tsipras to Belgrade a few, I think, weeks ago, where he met with the Minister of Labour, Aleksandar Vulin, who, you know, if anybody knows him, you know, his socialist movement is about, you know, is only indicative. The only socialist element is the fact that he has Che Guevara as his logo. I mean, other than that, his personal biography from Yule, which is, of course, Mira Markovic's party to, you know, kind of the darker ends of Serbian politics, means really that, you know, this is this kind of nationalist, pseudo-leftist politician, which if, you know, with friends like these, you're not projecting exactly the most confidence-inspiring image. So I think this, there one has to be looked at very carefully, which kind of parties claim to benefit or get encouragement by Syriza. But I think
Spain, that's a bit different. Podemos.
Yeah, that's different.
That's the other side.
Yeah, but you see also, I mean, you see also, you know, Die Linke in Germany is also, you know, very problematic kind of constellation, which tries to benefit from Syriza's victory. So I think we find it works in different directions. But I think in the Balkans, it's most likely to benefit parties which have a very problematic background, I would say.
I've got 5 more minutes. I'm going to take 3 questions. Please, 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 very quick.
Okay. Two quick questions. First one, sorry.
Pick your best one.
Okay. Only a comment on the role of opposition parties, mm-hmm. not a question. My question really is, having worked on EU-funded projects in the region for 10 years, it's very depressing to see not only that the region is not really going forward as we'd hoped, but it's actually going backwards. And I just wondered, if we had to concentrate on a certain area, what do we do next?
Okay. Really...
Yes, the position of the EU and Serbia, especially. We've heard of Mr. Vucic wants to be very much a member of the EU, and also Mr. Dacic is the other one. But both of them have completely changed by 180% their previous position. What does the EU want from Serbia? Dacic has said they want, at the time of, by the way, just after NATO bombing, they want a government which is going to sell below market prices. And Mr. Vucic's boss, Šešelj, is back in town now, you know. He was once asked, also before the NATO bombing, what does Serbia expect from the EU? What benefits is it going to get? And Mr. Šešelj had a very strong answer. He said, exactly what does Serbia offer to the EU? Because if we don't have anything to offer, you know, everything is the mutual advantage. What we've had from the EU is the EU is not saying it wants Serbia to recognize a part of the country which has been hived off. It wants to the party that will...
Thank you very much. Really, please. Okay. Beha.
I think it would be rude of us to speak about the crisis of democracy without mentioning the role of the US ambassadors in the region. So, very rude. So, as you know, in Kosovo, they have given a very incompetent president. They've tried to involve themselves in the elections of the Islamic community, and as we know, the former ambassador now works for a very big, large company who made the government pay almost $500 million for a few dozen kilometres of road. So just wondering if you could comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think three questions, very brief. What to do? That's, of course, Ashley's question, the most difficult question. I have no idea. No idea in the time allocated. But I think, I mean, maybe the point comes, I would answer maybe with the third question, which is about, you know, there's been a lot of use of informality by external actors, whether it is U.S. ambassadors legitimizing informal politics, and similar to Western involvement in Bosnia, which has been dealing with party presidents who have no political office and no elected office, but are seen as legitimate representative of somebody, but they're just party presidents. I mean, you know, you don't, as foreign visitors, you don't just go around. So there's been a tendency to legitimize the guys who are in power. or to be a power broker through informal practices. And then, of course, it's very hard to turn around and say, but you don't do any informal dealings, you know, behind the voters' backs. It's just reserved for us. I mean, it's not very credible to do that. So I think more respect for institutions is, I think, something which, when you talk to diplomats, they'll say, oh, you know, it's bothersome, I don't want to talk to these MPs, you know, they anyhow don't have anything to do, I just talk to Dodik or to Vucic or to Dacic or whoever else, because they're the ones who call the shots. But of course, if you do that, you actually empower them, and I think this is something that has to be more reflection of that. And then to the question of what Serbia has to offer, I think this is, again, I mean, it's partly the question generally in the region that there is a lack of debate domestically about, you know, what does EU membership mean, about the own agency in this process. I mean, again, I mean, there are multiple answers for it, but I think there's no debate. It's usually seen as just we want to join, and that's the end of the story. It's convenient for elites to also exculpate them of any reforms. You know, every reform gets the EU sticker on it, even if it has got nothing to do with the European Union, but it's a nice way to justify about just about anything you do. But it also postpones debate about what you want, what kind of economic policy, what kind of other policies. And I think that is not the EU's fault, but the EU has been a convenient cover for many of the elites to bypass these debates.
Before I say a very big thank you to Florian for coming along this evening, just a couple of notices about forthcoming talks. I hesitate to even mention this one. Tuesday, 10th of February, LSE Visiting Speaker Programme. You'll see why I said that. Bulgarians in Macedonia or Macedonians in Bulgaria, do they exist? Which is... a nice and provocative title from Kirill Drezov from Kiel University. That'll be here in 2 weeks, usual time, 6 till 7.30. And then the next one after that is on Tuesday, 24th of February, and that's the Politics of Europeanisation and Economic Nationalisms in Estonia and Slovenia, and that's Nicole Lindstrom from the University of York. So again, here at 6 o'clock on the 24th of February. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming this evening. It was absolutely fascinating, as I think we all expected and hoped. Yes, unfortunately, a rather negative picture that we're left with at the moment. But I think, you know, it was a very good opportunity to sort of really drill down. And I think a lot of the points that were raised, especially about the progress reports, are terribly important. It struck me that... when the latest round of progress reports came out, it seemed to take about 12 hours before anyone noticed that in the Macedonia report, the commissioner dropped the bombshell of saying, look, if you don't clean up your act, we don't think we can make the recommendation for the start of accession talks next year. As I say, it took hours before somebody realised that that is actually what the commission had said. So, you know, I think there is a very good argument that, you know, it really does need to start taking a much more sort of robust approach. Anyway, Florian, thank you very, very much again for coming this evening.